This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 224, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 200 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Becky Ferreira about her book. It's called First Contact, The Story of Our Obsession with Aliens. Becky is a regular contributor to the journalist-founded site 404 Media. She has her own newsletter, The Bex Files, and has bylines in the New York Times, Wired, MIT Technology Review, National Geographic, Motherboard, Supercluster, and many more. Hi, Becky. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Simon.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called First Contact, The Story of Our Obsession with Aliens. How is it that it came about for you to write this book? Is this something you've been interested in a long time?
Yeah, absolutely. I have always been interested in aliens. Mostly, I think when pop culture makes it kind of impossible not to be interested. And I was raised alongside like Star Trek Next Generation, Douglas Adams, and all of these kind of worlds that were populated by all these fantastical creatures. And when I was a teenager, I was really into the X-Files and things like that, too. So from that level, I was always really kind of interested in their footprint in our imaginations. And then I became a science reporter about 15 years ago and really started to cover it a lot as a topic of real scientific interest. And I think it was a really interesting time when I started because NASA's Kepler telescope had just been launched around the time I started writing. And that was, the first time we were really discovering all these exoplanets, these planets that are orbiting other stars in huge quantities. I think Kepler alone was responsible for a couple thousand discoveries along those lines. And I would talk to scientists and they would say, in about 10 or 15 years, we're going to be starting to characterize all these worlds and be able to have telescopes that can see atmospheric kind of constituents in there on these, distant planets that could potentially tell us whether there's life there. So I've actually been anticipating this moment for a long time. It was really great that I was able to be able to summarize some of it in the book form, because it actually really is a time that people have been looking forward to and working towards. And now we're in the fruits of all that labor of the past. And on the other side, you are so knowledgeable about UAP and UFO. That was UFOs. And that's like something that I hadn't really dived into until, of course, you have this wave of interest after the Pentagon UFO videos came out. And that was the first time I was really, they'd only been my periphery, but I was interested in looking into that as well. So I included some of that in the book as well, even though that's an area that I'm still new to and learning about. And then I also wanted to kind of just have a sort of holistic view on things. So I do think that there's almost like a universal interest in aliens. But people come at it from very different angles, right? Where kind of there's a siloing of communities and subcultures. And I hope that this book encourages people to start talking from different communities. And I've been very happy to see over the past couple of years that people who are really interested in UAP and alien abduction and these tales of like encounters are being talked more to scientists, and scientists are talking back. There's hopefully more of a push for like understanding each other along these lines. And then I think, the ubiquity of aliens in pop culture continues. So I think it's all important to talk about. And I'm hoping that the book, that's part of what I wanted this book to be, is a way to break some of the communication barriers down across all these different communities.
You say in the book, let's be real, the universe seems like a psychopath that wants us dead. That's kind of hinting at just how difficult it is for life to start in the first place.
It really seems to be a rarity. And, we had this expectation as humans, I think, for centuries that it was going to be common in our solar system. There were going to be life on the moon and Mars and everywhere. And that's just not the situation that we've come to see as we've explored further and further out. And of course, the eerie silence of when we start having these radio telescopes and other types of telescopes can look really deeply into space. Again, there was an expectation that, of course, there's going to be intelligent life elsewhere. It's going to be trying to communicate. And that's just not been the situation. Perhaps it is trying to communicate and we just simply haven't thought of the way that they would reach out to us. But that the way that we would think of, that's not what we're seeing. you know, we've sent radio transmissions out, of course, and we haven't seen similar things coming back to us. So, it just seems to be a really rare kind of a situation for non-living material to become living. At the same time, it is, we haven't explored fully. Like, there's signs that maybe there could have been past life on Mars, right? There's no confirmed detection, but there was a very compelling potential biosignature found by the Perseverance rover last year that it could be geological in origin. But when you see these kinds of patterns on Earth, it is often not. It is biological in origin. So maybe there, you know, I think we need to see, continue these kind of searches within our solar system and really confirm if we are alone in our own solar system. I would be surprised if there's complex life elsewhere, but perhaps there are microbes, in the oceans of Europa, or there's fossilized microbes from Mars's very early years when it was more habitable. And that would tell us, you know, if we do find that, then it means that the threshold to at least simple life is lowered. The complex life is the one that I always just, I really, really don't know. There's a really good book called The Rare Earth, It's this rare earth hypothesis that perhaps simple life is very common, but, it took a long time on Earth for complex life to emerge. And it took a lot of, you know, really special coincidences to happen. So maybe that's something that the threshold is at the single cell to the multi-cell is really the thing that is difficult to happen in the universe. Then you just have the environments that you see in space, right? We see these planets that are, you know, hell worlds and, like, you know, acids raining from the sky. And it just, that's what I mean when I say the universe seems like a psychopath. We have this beautiful planet and we've assumed that is some kind of environment that might exist elsewhere. But when we actually look out there, gosh, it is, you wouldn't want to live on the moon or Mars or any of these places, right? They are very inhospitable. And the imagination of the universe for making nightmare worlds is truly endless. So, then you just have things like also supernovas and, you know, gamma ray bursts and things that can just eradicate a world. You know, complex life may emerge, but what if a planet rolls by and takes it out into interstellar space, right? There's a million ways to die in space. So that's sort of what I mean, is we've kind of realized, like, we have a false sense of safety, I think, on the Earth. It is actually quite a nightmarish world out there.
Yeah, I think there was something in the Victorian era where there was such a massive coronal mass ejection from the sun. I think it was called the Carrington event. And if that had hit us now, it would have destroyed so much of our infrastructure.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, it's like, what, 1859 or something, I feel like. And the fact that it was, so detectable then. Yeah, I assume that we're due for that at some point in the future. So yeah, it is a wild world out there.
We're looking at Venus now and Mars and how they're so inhospitable. But there was a time in the past where both of them were, you know, the right kind of temperature, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is interesting in our own solar system that we have these kind of different models for how planets can go. It's possible that Venus and Mars and Earth were all inhabited at the very early solar system, right? Like 4.5 billion years ago or 4 billion years ago. Earth life is, I think, dated to about shortly, you know, like 3.8 billion years ago or something like that is when it seems to have, we think that it is clearly there. But, you know, Mars had a lot of water back when it was forming. It had big lakes and rivers and channels. They may have been transient, you know, it might have been this kind of going through dry periods and floods, but there's plenty of evidence that there was liquid water there. And so that's why Perseverance is in an ancient lake bed to look for fossils that might have not be surviving there. So that was definitely a place that could have been habitable at one point. But Mars lost its atmosphere, and now it is very irradiated. And it's hard to imagine that anything could survive on the surface because the sun's radiation, cosmic radiation, is so intense there. And it's, of course, very cold. And then Venus had the, you know, nobody's really sure if it had water. It could have. So it's possible that there was maybe even microbial life there early on. But then it had this runaway greenhouse effect, of course, that has kind of smothered everything and made it sort of the archetypal, you know, nightmare world in our solar system. I do think it's a beautiful planet, but can you imagine being on that surface where it's hot enough to melt lead and there's sulfuric acid raining from the sky and the pressure is like 100, no, what is it? Okay, so several hundred, I think, more than Earth's surface. So it's just, you have these different planets that all may have been habitable at first, and it kind of shows how maybe transient life might be out there in the universe, because Earth is the only one that had this really special combination of factors, both in terms of its orbital distance from the sun, but also just the fact that it's tectonically active is very helpful for keeping the habitable conditions going. And that life, you know, may have kind of created a situation on Earth where it was kind of self-propelling after a certain point. There are theories that life on Mars may have kind of changed the Martian atmosphere and kind of killed itself off. So it's not, you know, I think they're called mainly the Gaia and the Medea hypothesis, that life can either be its own end or it can maybe create a situation that allows it to self-propel a little bit more. So it really, really just, it seems to be a very, what's the word? It's sort of a statistical probabilities thing. And then, you know, a lot of the solar systems we see have gas giants that are very close to the sun. We are very lucky that Jupiter migrated outwards, because you don't want gas giants messing with your orbit and things like that. So there's just like a million ways. Like there's a lot of evidence that there's, you know, trillions of rogue planets kind of just roaming in interstellar space that got kicked out of their star system. So there's that possibility that your planet could just, you know, be ejected from a star, and that's not going to be great for life on that planet in most cases, right? So,
yeah.
And sometimes even planets get ejected into their stars, right? There's lots of examples now of stars that have eaten their planets because they were basically chucked in by a passing, you know, gas giant or whatever. And so that would be a bad situation as well. In any case, there's just a million ways it can go, and it seems like the Earth way is very, very rare.
And also looking at the life that, say, billions of years ago may have been on Mars,
mm-hmm.
I suppose you could look at it as that there was a point where there was a lifespan on Mars and that went away. And then millions and millions of years later, we come along and there's the lifespan on Earth. And we could look at that scenario across the whole of a galaxy or the universe and think, well, maybe there was life on other planets, but that was billions of years ago and that's died out now. So it could be coming and going, but for us mm-hmm. to be at the same point in the process where there's life here and life there might be a really chancy thing, because, you know, the universe is so old, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's interesting to think if it might be more common that life might emerge, but it's just so rare that a planet remains habitable for such a long time that it kind of is a bottleneck. And maybe you don't get complex life emerging just because the planetary habitability is not that long. So that's something to think about for sure. And, you know, you even think about humans. We're not very old creatures, right? We anatomically modern humans are, you know, a couple hundred thousand years old. And we've only started to be technologically able to produce transmissions or listen into transmissions in the last 100 years or so, right? So you think about just the fact that it's like there could be plenty of these worlds out there that are inhabited, but it's another question to have the impulse to actually want to look for other species. So you may have, you know, we got plenty of intelligent species on Earth, like whales and chimps and things like that, and octopuses, but they don't have a program to look for other aliens. And I think that would be fascinating to think about too, that there may be just, you know, those kinds of worlds that aren't really interested or curious about that, or maybe they don't even know that there's a universe out there.
You were talking about how we've been using radio waves for around 100 years, mm-hmm. but the Earth technology is evolving and we've got the internet and so much more is done online rather than through transmissions. And maybe in another 100 years, we never use radio.
Right.
So the lifespan of our broadcast from Earth will only be 200 years long.
Right.
Which might be the same for other planets. So that's even shorter window to try and find them.
Yeah. And, you know, who knows what technologies in the future will come across and be like, this is the obvious bandwidth that we should be using or whatever. Right. And I, you know, it is always like a kind of frustrating and tantalizing thought to think that aliens are trying or see us and are trying to say, like, why aren't they tuning into this kind of special technology that we just haven't thought of yet? But yeah, no, our technological lifespan is very short, and there's no guarantee. You know, it's hard to think about how another species would want to communicate. And I think it's interesting, the history of SETI, to see scientists working through that question and trying to think, what's the first principles that any species that was trying to communicate would know? And, you know, I talk in the book a bit about the hydrogen line, which is this idea that they would be, the obvious place to communicate would be the frequency of neutral hydrogen in the universe, just because if you were a scientist, you would know that that's a very important frequency. But I mean, that's not actually intuitive to most people, right? So I think that's like one of these things where, you know, it's just impossible to imagine a data set that you've never seen. And it could well be that maybe we are on the radar of aliens out there, but they just either aren't interested, or they're just like this civilization hasn't yet, you know, evolved the capacity to communicate on this particular technological frequency or whatever, which is always very frustrating for me to think about.
Well, maybe they're out there thinking the same way, kind of like Stephen Hawking put it, that when more advanced societies meet others, it doesn't work out for the lesser advanced society.
Sure.
So maybe they're out there thinking, don't contact anyone just in case.
Yeah, I think that's called the dark forest hypothesis, right? That maybe aliens are just self-preservation kind of mindset. They why would you advertise your location when you don't really know what kind of predators are out there? Obviously, we are a species that was once much more entrenched into the food chain, and we would have to worry about these things more. Now we're more, I think, scared of each other than scared of being in a food web. But I think, you know, that there's every reason to suspect that maybe an intelligent alien species would have also evolved in a context where they had predators that kind of impulse to think, well, what if there are predators in the broader universe? And obviously, this is a big part of science fiction, the worry that could be the case. And then there's the idea, too, there's an Earth Zoo hypothesis that, you know, there are intelligent aliens, but they kind of want to have a prime directive about Earth, and they don't want to interfere in our affairs because, you know, they want to remain aloof about it for whatever reason. So it could be that we are, you know, being watched in that way. I think all of these are really fascinating hypotheses, but it's hard to bring a lot of ground truth to them without being able to detect worlds that clearly have pollution or techno signatures or things like that out there.
And there's also a depiction in science fiction, say Star Trek or Star Wars, that all the other aliens have the same IQ as us. They have the same attitudes and motives and emotions. But it could be that if we do contact an alien civilization, the mode of communication, the way they think, would be so different to us, maybe we couldn't communicate.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's a rare type of science fiction, but you see that kind of in Solaris, where it's like there is an attempt from that alien to communicate, but it doesn't really seem to know, you know, there's just such a language barrier. There's just such a entity barrier in terms of the worldview of both. I think Arrival is really good for this too, even though communication is possible in that movie. It's like such a truly alien way of looking at the world that species in the movie and the Ted Chiang story that inspired it. You know, they experience time simultaneously, which is a difficult barrier and worldview to cross when you're trying to talk to each other. It's funny because a lot of scientists that I interview actually kind of are optimistic that there won't be that barrier. They think that, I just had a conversation the other day with someone who was saying, you know, if it's a self-selected population, if there's intelligent species that also want to communicate, they'll be using the language of science, and that won't be actually that much of a problem. It's actually just kind of finding those self-selected kind of intelligent aliens, and we have no idea the statistical odds of that. Just as we just discussed, it's not clear how common simple life is, how common complex life is there, and then that's a whole other, you know, as we can assume that probably no other species on planet Earth for as many species that have existed have ever tried to radio or to receive transmissions from other planets. I mean, maybe there was a T-Rex doing it. I would love that. But, you know, I think that we're probably the only ones that have ever done that. And so that, you know, the entire 3.5, 3.8 billion history of life on Earth, to have one species doing that is like kind of tells you it might be quite rare out there. But it's been interesting to me how many scientists do think it's like the barrier is finding the message. The message won't be difficult because if they're sending it, they want it to be understood. And there's a motivation on both sides at that point. Now, if this is a species that was like 500 light years away, then you're dealing with having a very long conversation. But that's the thinking anyway.
Yeah, because 500 light years away with a radio transmission takes 500 years to get there. Nobody could really have a conversation because the round trip is 1,000 years.
Yeah, and who knows how long their lifespan is. But for us, right, that is very, you know, that's in the best circumstance, you have a millennium for a two-way conversation. You know, so they are going to be talking to a completely different generation when they send their message back, right? Than the people that initially reached out. So it is like very mind-boggling to think about having to have any kind of interstellar communication on that level would be something you'd have to, you know, you would not be possible to be in one lifespan, and you'd have to just think, well, my great 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 grandchildren might, you know, be able to say what I wanted to say. But I think that's actually something that would be the silver lining of that is that I do think people should think about multi-generational kind of consequences more. You know, that was very much a traditional thinking kind of worldview, but I think we've sort of lost that in the short-term gain cycle we're in now. And especially, you know, being someone who's interested in the history of the search for aliens, I feel part of that continuum, right? I mean, people have wanted to answer this question for literally tens of thousands of years, and they have laid all this imaginative groundwork for us, and we're delivering on it now. And, you know, I think it's something to be cherished and maybe like encouraged to think about what humans are going to be doing 1,000 years from now, 2,000 years from now, and think about them as people that we wanted to give as much as we could the way that so many people in our past did. And so so that is the silver lining, is that I think it would be a good way to encourage us to get back into a longer term thinking cycle.
So how far back in history did humans start thinking of life on other planets?
I really believe that this is like the impulse, the basic impulse is tens of thousands of years old, because you see that every culture on Earth looks at the stars. They tell stories about the stars. They assume that that space is inhabited, even if it's in as divinities, right? You don't get the kind of idea of aliens as like biological life forms till later. But the basic impulse, like, we're not alone. Clearly there's something out there, and the sky is this canvas for communication, right? Like a comet or an eclipse or things like that, that's meaningful, and we need to extract some kind of message from beyond. From that, that is all like, I think, pretty much in our hardware going back as long as we've been recognizably human. You know, the question of like when we start to think about aliens in the modern sense, that they're life forms like us that inhabit planetary surfaces usually. Though maybe they don't, but that's another question. I think that is more, it starts happening around 2,500 years ago with the ancient Greeks in the Hellenistic period. That is when you get people sort of talking about what if all the stars and the planet and everything we're seeing, the objects out there, is similar to Earth. You know, the rise of cosmic pluralism and atomism kind of comes around this time in the ancient Greek world, where they start talking about maybe we're all made of these very elemental kind of particles, and that would mean that all the planets are like that, and that would mean that, I mean, you know, life could arise on any planet. And it was a sort of decentering of Earth, you know, or in most mythologies, Earth is really kind of special and central, but this was like kind of moving it into this is just one of many worlds kind of a view. And then that kind of got crushed by Plato and Aristotle, who reasserted this idea of Earth as somehow different. The sky is operating on different rules than Earth does. There's a separation. And those kind of thoughts go really deeply into Christianity, which was generally thought that the plurality of worlds idea was heretical for a long time. So it's interesting. So you have this sort of like basic idea of what are we special or not? And I think that's still kind of the debate today, right? We don't really know. But that was definitely the sort of initial, I think, framing of the main debate. And then you have lots of cultures that, you know, have like a lot of folk traditions and things like that. They're very animist. So they might, you know, see the moon as alive, even if it doesn't have like life in the same way we would describe it in a scientific level. You know what I mean? So I think there's like just really interesting and fascinating history on this. Certainly people have thought about it for, you know, in the modern sense of how we think about aliens, like for thousands of years. And the more that we discover, you know, the more that certain parts of this this idea are constrained. Like, for example, now the Catholic Church accepts the idea of aliens and stuff like that. They have changed their theology on the idea. And there's actually like a, I think, an astronomer who at the Vatican Observatory who like is an expert on the kind of theology of this question. So it is really interesting. And I think it, you know, it challenges our idea of ourselves as special. And a lot of religions and spiritual traditions never thought that we were special in the first place. So it's like, it's kind of fascinating to see how it's refracted through all of those different viewpoints through time. But it really sort of gets refined as a real scientific question during the scientific revolution. And since then, there's been sort of this alien optimist kind of community, like, how could it be possible that we're the only life form, you know, given the statistics? And the sort of alien pessimist community that's like, well, you know, why haven't we found them then, you know? So a lot of the essential questions we discuss in science today, they have such deep origins. They're very much the same questions that were debated amongst, like, you know, priests and politicians and all these people in the ancient world.
We tend to think, or I think, of science fiction starting perhaps with Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, but did it go back hundreds of years or thousands of years? Do you know when the first kind of science fiction aliens thing was written?
Yeah, the one that's usually cited is this book called True History by Lucian, or I'm not sure if it's Lucian, maybe a Syrian writer from, I think he was in the first century AD, so 2,000 years ago. And it's a really funny story. It's short, and I recommend people read it because I always like connecting and realizing the stuff that is written such a long time ago is still relevant and funny. And it's a satire, and it's about a crew of sailors that get lost in the sea and end up on the moon. A big whirlwind comes and takes them to the moon, and they find this whole warring society up there. And, you know, he's doing a lot of satire of the kind of stuff that's going on in his time through these alien characters. But I mean, these are aliens. They're living on the moon, and they have their own customs. They look strange. So in that sense, that is very much an alien story. And I do think also you can make the case that sky gods and celestial gods are like a proto-alien kind of a mold. They don't necessarily mean the same things, but a lot of the kind of ideas that we have about aliens today, for example, you know, abduction. Lots of gods abduct humans in like Greek myths and things like that, right? There's sort of this idea that we are being watched, and actually the kind of celestial entities, whether they're divinities or aliens, they come down all the time, and they may disguise themselves as people. And, you know, this is still very much a part of alien lore today. So you do have science fiction that goes back that far. And then I think, you know, Jules Verne is a great example, because it's almost as if like it's the popularization of scientific principles and, you know, kind of the dawn of hard science fiction, maybe, where a lot of, you know, there was a mass reading audience for the first time in Verne's time. Like, people were widely literate, you know, mass market fiction had an audience, and people were really interested in learning about the kind of scientific stuff at the time, but they wanted to like have a fun time reading it. He was so instrumental in, you know, Verne was in really catapulting curiosity about all these topics. And again, that's something that I do really appreciate and love about humans. We do get a bad rap for ourselves and we beat ourselves up a lot, which is fine. But we are very curious. And if you give people the opportunity to learn about science and interesting kind of topics and exploration and all this, they will take it. And Verne was a master of that and kind of inspired Wells and all this tradition of really supercharging science fiction in all ways, including especially aliens, I would say. They become this really big obsession in the 20th century and beyond. They've always been kind of latently popular. I talk in the book about one example where in 1835, the New York Sun, a penny press paper, wrote this big article claiming that there was a civilization on the moon that John Herschel had spotted, which was all fake. But people it was like one of the most popular stories of the time. I mean, people loved it. So I do think that you can't underestimate the power of the alien at any time. But now we've really, you know, I feel like now you see more aliens in modern popular culture than you see humans. Like there's just, they're just ubiquitous, right? So, I'm not sure if I answered your question there, but I do think it's always been like part of our idea. We love to tell stories about what might be living beyond Earth. And I think that is a really ancient impulse, even if science fiction as its like modern form is only maybe 150 years old. And it certainly didn't evolve out of nothing.
As H.G. Wells wrote War of the Worlds, which was, I believe, about an invasion from Mars.
Uh-huh.
And it does sound crazy to think as late as the 20th century, people still believe there was civilization on Mars.
Yeah, it was very, I think probably more people believed it than didn't. There was a real expectation. And, you know, part of this was because that was coming from scientists. Percival Lovell was, you know, the most famous person, and also in Italy, Schiaparelli. I think Percival Lovell was really the one that promoted it the most. And he was working throughout the late 1800s, early 1900s. And he was a very accomplished astronomer, but he you know, saw these Martian surface features as, telescopes developed to be able to see such details on Mars. And, you know, immediately thought like this looks like a civilization. And of course, the famous like idea of irrigation canals and then science fiction writers grafted onto that. Oh, well, they've got irrigation canals. They're dying. They're losing water. And it's a whole mythology arises around these scientific observations that were misinterpreted by Lovell. And so that was part of it. And then you also had people like Nikola Tesla. Really, he believed he was getting radio messages from Mars. Like he would say this all the time that he was communicating with Martians and stuff. And Marconi, the early radio pioneer, also said such things. So I don't blame people for thinking that there was a civilization on Mars. I mean, that's what the experts were saying we should expect. There's actually a big celebration in 1924 when the Mars opposition happened that year when Mars and Earth were very close, that people were expecting to like look through telescopes and literally see these signs of civilization. And in the States, the Navy actually shut down all radio, had a period of radio silence every hour so that we could try to finally get like some messages from Mars. So it was really widespread belief. And then of course, you know, actually Venus as well, I would say. Venus was thought to have dinosaurs on it and things like that because you really couldn't see past the cloud cover. And then we start sending probes in the 60s and 70s. And it's, you know, well before then, I think most people suspected based on telescope observations that they were not inhabited. But that certainly, killed the dream a bit when we could see with Venus, especially that it would be very difficult for life to live there. And with Mars, that these surface features that seem so obviously artificial in origin were simply natural features on Mars. So I think it is really, it shows that the kind of classic X-Files motto, right? I want to believe. We really do. And that's, I think, informed the sort of very stringent skepticism that scientists kind of have today because we've been through these cycles of disappointment and of letting our desire to find aliens shape how we actually see data.
Because there's radio signals that have come in, and I think you list a couple in the book. It's like the wow signal.
Oh, yeah.
There's something that came in, and it that really is peculiar, but we just don't know what it is.
There was a really interesting study 2 years ago about the wow signal that Abel Mendez, he's a very, very good astronomer at Arecibo. He was looking, and he studies like planetary habitability. So just to give some context, the wow signal was this really interesting narrowband signal detected in 1975 that has been like the strongest evidence of an alien transmission for, you know, the decades since. But it was never repeated. And the scientists have assumed that if an alien sent a beacon, they would repeat it so that it would be obviously artificial. That's what we think that we would probably do, right? This Mendez study from 2 years ago, he basically saw that there's these clouds of neutral hydrogen, just cold clouds of hydrogen in the galaxy, that if they are hit by a flare the right way, they make a really similar kind of a narrowband signal. So this was, you know, maybe it was an alien signal, but this was, I think, an example of why scientists are always like demand such a high, level of evidence for techno signature or biosignature, because now he's said, well, look, this, it could be this. I mean, it's the exact same kind of pattern. And it's basically something like a magnetar, which is this type of dead star that flares with a lot of energy. If that kind of flare hit one of these clouds, it makes a wow signal, basically. And that would explain also why it was transient, right? I think that's the thing. As long as there's going to be a non-alien explanation, it's really difficult to just ascribe alienness to something. I think this is like the same thing that you kind of see playing out with the interstellar object debate, where because Oumuamua, the interstellar object's the first one that was discovered in 2017, because it was such a weird object, maybe it was a piece of alien detritus. But you can make all these other natural explanations. So it's like, you know, it's we're getting to that point where it is really fascinating to have these kind of detections that have a possible alien origin. But until you can get the baseline separated from the noise, it's really difficult to actually say, like, that is a clear alien signal. So far, that's the best explanation for the wow signal, I think, is the Mendez study. But, you know, if we were to see, for example, another signal like that in the same place or with the same exact frequency band, like, that would be pretty compelling, I think, for looking further and trying to see if there was any way you could separate a technological origin from a just a natural, you know, space is very loud sometimes. There's a lot of really extreme things happening, so it's difficult to tease those things out.
Because SETI has been listening for a long time, hasn't it? But
yeah.
Even though it's been listening so long, I think in the book you point out the amount of space that it's listened to is absolutely tiny.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't listen everywhere all the time. I think the analogy that Jason Wright, who I quoted in the book for that, was that it's as if we've looked at a bathtub worth of water from the Pacific Ocean or something like that. Like, it's just... And that's only assuming that they would be communicating through radio, right? So I do think, as much as it's been surprising to see that we're not seeing like clear evidence of how we would communicate coming back to us, like we can't look at all the sky all at once. And surprisingly, SETI is very underfunded, given how much people are interested in aliens. It's not a well-funded area. And, you know, like, especially, I think, you know, the 80s and 90s, it was basically not publicly funded at all. Scientists had to turn to private philanthropy and stuff like that to fund it. So I hope that this kind of interest in aliens does yield some more support for people involved in that field. But yeah, it is. It's a big universe. We only have so much telescope time. And so I think that it's why it wouldn't surprise me. And if any day there was a strong signal or something like that, I do think, you know, just because we've been searching since really the 60s with modern style telescopes, I think it really starts at Green Bank in West Virginia. That's like sort of the dawn of the modern listening kind of approach. So that's a long time, but also, you know, in the scope of the universe, it's not that long. It's about 70 years, right? Or 60 years. So we haven't been looking long and we haven't looked at most of the sky. And so we just got to keep going. And you know, the incidental thing, we'll learn a lot about the cool natural stuff, right? Like, it's looking for techno signatures as a way of screening the sky for interesting, weird, unusual events that mostly end up being natural in origin, but that's really a cool thing to learn as well.
So there were biosignatures that showed up from Mars, weren't there? There was Vikings biosignatures, and then there was the meteorite, which I think came from Antarctica, that had something in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But with the Viking ones, what do you make of that, the Viking landers on Mars?
Yeah, and we're actually coming up on the 50th anniversary this summer of that, and I'd love to even do a deeper dive up for that, because I don't know. That is a really difficult one, and when I talk to scientists about this one, there's a really wide range of it. It's, again, this problem of, like, it could have been, there's natural explanations. And so just to give some context, Viking had an experiment called the LR experiment, the labeled release experiment, that was it took a sample, and it basically, like, gave the sample a little nourishment and looked for microbial activity in it by looking to see if gases associated with life were released. And then it took another sample and a rat in, like, you know, basically vaporized it, like put it at a really high temperature, did the same experiment. So the idea was, like, you would kill the microbes in one if they existed, and you would nourish them in the other, so you would see the difference. The landers got positive results. Like, it was, it seemed as if there was something creeping in the sample. And so now we know that there's a lot of compounds on Mars, especially perchlorates that we didn't know at the time were on Mars, that can give these kinds of false positives. So again, it's like, maybe that was it, but it's going to be really tantalizing to imagine that actually, you know, the sample, the experiment worked as intended. I mean, they did this kind of experiment on Earth many times, and really Mars produced the exact same results as Earth did. So it would be great, I think, to go back at some point to the Viking sites and sample again with a instrument that can have more precision and, like, keep the false positive thing in mind and, like, be able to tell if this is a gas that is being released by exotic compounds on Mars that we didn't know were there before, or if that is, like, genuinely there is microbial life on Mars. As I said, I would be very surprised if there is, because, you know, the radiation environment on Mars is very intense and it's very difficult for life to arise in that kind of environment. But, I mean, it is this giant question mark, and I think people should be open to the idea of either option there. And actually, the guy who designed the experiment, Gilbert Levin, he spent the rest of his life saying he believed that it was microbes that they had detected, and we detected life on Mars. And so I do think as the 50th anniversary of that one comes up, we should all, like, maybe revisit that. And, it's a story as well about how, like, in the 70s, like, this kind of instrumentation was much more primitive, and, like, we've got more sensitive equipment now. That having been said, it's the same story again with Perseverance. Perseverance detected this really interesting redox reaction pattern in one of its samples. And there is, again, geological origin for that, but it's much more on Earth. It's more commonly made by microbes. Then in that case, it would be, if it was a microbe, probably a microbe that is that existed 4 billion years ago. That's just, like, the fossilized remains of that. But still, I mean, until we get those samples back, Perseverance is not able to, it's just a little rover. It doesn't have the laboratory equipment that would be required to really make a smoking gun case for either one. So I do think it's really, in the near term, if we want to know whether we're the only life forms in the universe, Mars is really the testing ground for that. And I hope we can get those samples back in the next, 10 years or so. There's a plan to get them back, but it's, again, it's underfunded. So, it literally annoys me every day that the sample is on Mars and not here, because it's like, that could be the easiest near-term way to determine if we're alone or not. And if it is microbes, then we know, that the threshold for life is actually really low. Even if it's just microbial life, if there's the environment, then you're going to get life emerging, which is just like such an important data point to fill. So I do think, you know, Mars is fascinating in that way. And it's possible, too, that perhaps it has microbes that have, you know, that now survive by going underground into water reservoirs that are deeper underground that are safe from the radiation. People have talked about putting probes in the cave atmospheres or the cave environments on Mars. There's a lot of lava tubes and caves and things like that that would be protected from radiation underground. So the idea of going into a Martian cave and finding some bugs in there is really exciting to me. The fact that we haven't found it there so far, I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, that we've gotten some very interesting things. Oh, and then the last one you mentioned, the meteorite, that was pretty, I think the consensus is now that there was a meteorite from Antarctica, from Mars, that had these really interesting microscopic patterns in it that looked like a worm, like it was like worm or bacteria had made it. And there is a pretty clear geological origin for that now. I can't remember the details of that one, but that was an interesting kind of episode because Phil Clinton like announced that, you know, we might have discovered life on Mars and everything. So it became a big story. I think the consensus is now that is not a fossil. Even so, you know, you can see, even if these are not life, like you can see that the complexification of abiotic materials into things that's starting to look like life. I mean, that's how we assume life emerged on Earth as well. It wasn't like it just suddenly sprung up one day. It's a process of nucleic acids and these nucleobases slowly accumulating, self-replicating in some way. And at some point along the line, it may be really a gradient as to whether we would consider something alive or not. And there is plenty of these kind of microscopic structures on Earth that we don't know if they're made by life or if they're geological. And we have the sample right there, and we can look at it with the best lab equipment, and it's still really unclear because, you know, it's just hard to know when on this complexification process you can really call something alive.
And life on Earth shows up in really inhospitable places, doesn't it? Like mm-hmm. where the heat's extreme or the cold is extreme, and we wouldn't have expected that.
Yeah, totally. I think this is such an interesting thing, too, that kind of goes back a couple centuries. I really fascinated by the work of Christian Huygens, the Dutch polymath from the Scientific Revolution. I think he's 1600s, 1700s when he was living. He was one of the first people to be looking at microbes and looking through microscopes. And he realized, like, holy cow, like, if we didn't even know these guys were here, of course there's going to be microbes on other planets, right? We didn't even know we had this whole biosphere. And that continues today where you just, you know, it's incredible the adaptations that these microbes have. They can live in the most salty imaginable environments, really hot, really cold, no oxygen. You know, life is probably quite deep into the seabed too, and sunless places, hydrothermic vents, like all these amazing environments. And even in space, right? They've put tardigrades on the hull of the ISS, and they go into their little fun state. These are like very tiny microscopic animals that are charismatic extremophiles because they're very cute as well as being very hardy. But they just go into like sort of a cryo sleep, and they can survive not having water, not being exposed to the vacuum of space, the cold, the radiation, and they just survive it. They just pop back out again when they're put into a more habitable position, right? So the idea that this is like both really exciting for the idea that maybe Mars does just have a relict biosphere, basically extremophiles that have learned how to deal with the very, very inhospitable conditions there. But it's also a consideration. It's very difficult to actually stop life from coming with us on our space missions. So we don't want to be going to Mars and like bringing all these extremophiles that then we find them and we're not sure if they're Martian or from us. So that sort of gets into the planetary protection part of it. But I just find it amazing that, you know, Earth is just so bursting with life. I mean, we really do, wherever you look, it's there. And so it does seem to, it stands to reason that if it's real, if it's so just resilient in so many environments on Earth, why wouldn't it be so persistent elsewhere? I think that's yeah, really interesting to think about.
So what can you tell us about Europa and Enceladus? Because they're kind of ice moons, aren't they?
Yeah, so these are, Europa is the moon of Jupiter. Enceladus is much smaller. It's only 300 miles across, actually. It's really small. But Europa is, I think, about on par with our moons. And they both have subsurface oceans. Europa may have 2 to 3 times as much water in its ocean as Earth has in all seas. It's got a huge ocean inside of its, underneath its ice shell. And the ice is, I think, about 60 miles thick is the estimate. So this is just like a fascinating possibility that, you know, where there's liquid water, you might get life. That has been sort of our guiding principle, considering that water is essential to every life form on Earth. And it really seems to be the catalyst for life here. One thing that's really interesting is that these moons are very far out of our habitable zone, as we understand it. They're way on the outer solar system. So these are not going to be sun-based life forms. They're not going to be doing photosynthesis. But we know from Earth that lots of life lives around these hydrothermal vents on the bottom of the ocean. They use chemical energy as opposed to sunlight to create to fuel their metabolisms. And they can be quite rich ecosystems, right? Like, they're not just microbial. They got animals and tube worms and things like that that live off of these ecosystems and don't need sun. So in theory, it could be that these are, you know, hidden populated worlds. And it's interesting to me that, you know, the more that we study these outer solar system moons, the more it seems like there's evidence of all kinds of these subsurface oceans. I mean, there's moons of Uranus and Jupiter and Saturn that also seem to have these subsurface oceans. And some may be brinier, some may be saltier, some may be smaller. Enceladus is, as I mentioned, really small. But, they're orbiting these giant worlds that are causing tidal heating. They're basically, their gravity is stretching the world, stretching these moons, which generates heat in their cores. So you could imagine that you could have some kind of chemical energy that is running a system down there. And again, it's another thing that one of the things that's fascinating about Enceladus is that it's spewing a lot of its ocean out into space. So in theory, you could just send a probe there to look for life in that, in those plumes. I wish we would just do this. Because again, it could be another real slam dunk in a near term way. Obviously Saturn's very far. It would take a decade to send a probe out there. But, you know, if we could just determine if there's microbes getting, you know, just geysered into space, like, that would be an easy way to answer this ultimate question. And so, I think it's really fascinating to think that could, you know, the most common liquid water habitats in our solar system appear to not be the thing that we're looking for in other solar systems. It is these ice moons. And imagine the life, if there's intelligent life in Europa, right? It might not know that there's a whole galaxy out here, right? Like, it could be life that is attuned to geothermic energy and, like, you know, tremors in the ice shell and things like that. It there's a really interesting book by Kevin Hand that I recommend to anyone interested in these moons called Alien Oceans, where he kind of speculates on what intelligent life in these moons could be like and how they might communicate and things like that. But it fascinates me to imagine that there could be life forms in so many of these ice moons across the galaxy, and they really might not know. This could be their landlocked in the most, like, literal sense. They cannot see. And so so that is a really fascinating thing to think about as well, that this could be, like, just a very common place to find life. But we'll have to just go and look. The Europa Clipper, NASA's mission, is currently en route to Jupiter. It's going to fly by several times. So it should be able to constrain things, but it's not designed to go into the ocean or detect life or anything. It's more just trying to be a recon mission for hopefully future missions that will go there and see, yeah, if this is inhabited or not.
And you point out in the book that the ecosystem is underneath a planetary shield. So as we talked earlier about Earth could be hit by all sorts of things, that mm-hmm. ecosystem is shielded by 60 miles of ice.
Right. I mean, if life is able to emerge there, it's actually much more stable environment, potentially, right? Like, it's not going to get hit by a solar flare. Jupiter has intense radiation. It is totally safe from that. with this big ice shell. So it's possible that these are much more stable environments than any kind of planetary surface living. You know, we've been assuming that the life forms we're going to find are surface creatures like us. But actually, it's quite dangerous to be a surface creature. You know, there's a big question about these red dwarf worlds where, you know, stars much smaller than us. They could be much better places to have life because they're much more long-lived. You know, these are stars that live for tens of billions of years. But they flare, you know, they flare a lot. So people think they might just irradiate the life around them. However, if they were in an ice moon, they'd be fine. So it is a really interesting question. The thinking about how an environment that is like truly so different from the one that we experience on Earth, how it could actually benefit in a long-term way any life forms that arise on it.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book is First Contact, The Story of Our Obsession with Aliens. And that's on Amazon, isn't it?
Yeah, it's everywhere. I think every bookstore you can find. And my website is beckyferrer.com, so you can get the links there as well. And I really enjoyed talking to you, Simon. This was a really fascinating conversation. Thank you.
That was an interview with Becky Ferreira about her book, First Contact, The Story of Our Obsession with Aliens. If you really want to support the podcast, you could sign up to Patreon, where you get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my book. It's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, and it's on Amazon. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.